Until the Yom Kippur War, Americans were not bothered by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. They didn't want to get involved with dual citizenship. America objected to Americans serving. The Israelis didn't want to cross them. And then came the Yom Kippur War. And I have to tell you, until today, I frankly don't understand how we survived. There was no one that Yom Kippur between Syria and Tel Aviv, and between Egypt and Beersheba. There were great miracles, but a tremendous loss of life. Some of you studied with me in BMT, the first Torah institution organized to export Torah to the Anglo world. Two of our madrichim did not return from the Yom Kippur War. After the Yom Kippur War, any male who walked upright was drafted. So I'm drafted, and they start playing games. They have to build up a unit, people my age, my health category. Finally, on Tiny Desta, 1976, yours truly goes into basic training. By Jordanian war bonds, the Israeli army has drafted Aaron Rakeff. Going to basic, and I live with a motto. I've taught it to my children, my grandchildren. I hope to teach it to the next generation as well. Be'ezrat Hashem. When you do something, do it seriously. Well, I took it very seriously. Wake up 4:30, daven, running, shooting, whatever the commanders say, I'm following. I'm in love. Once a week we would hear a lecture from an officer from the education division of the army. It was called Chel HaChinuch. And he gets up, the first week we're there, he gives a lecture on a raid of our troops into Beirut in 1968, and how smart they were, and they want to give you pride in the army. A week later we're all assembled, 200 soldiers, the same second Mishneh, second lieutenant walks in, and he starts giving the same lecture. And I was happy. I figured you can't sleep because they woke up and down and wake you up, but I'd sleep with my eyes open. But the Russians started yelling, Shamanu, we heard, we heard. And suddenly this dummy walks off the stage. He knew one lecture. He didn't have a second lecture. And I see the sergeants are in conference, and then like a movie, the master sergeant walks over to me, and until then I was called Hayal. You don't have a name in basic training. You have to break you as an individual and become part of a group. Hayal, Hayal, soldier, soldier. Suddenly this master sergeant comes over to me, Kvod Harav, if you know Martin Hebrew. Oh boy, I said, something is the matter here. And he says, Anachnu yodim shata yodeya eich lahavir sicha. We know you know how to deliver a talk. Save us. Get up there and deliver a talk. And here I am. It's Erev Chodesh Nisan. And 200 soldiers, and everyone jumps forward. And I ask them, I say, I'll say it in English, but of course this was all in Hebrew. Gentlemen, tell me, how many covenants were there? How many brichot were there with the Jew and the Almighty? Two. Avraham Avinu, Brit Ben HaBetarim, the original covenant, and then Moshe Rabbeinu, Yetziat Mitzrayim, Matan Torah. Wait a minute, I said. What do we need two covenants for? If Avraham is a Jew, what do we need the second one for? And if the second one makes us Jewish, does that mean to say that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah were not Jewish? I didn't tell them that Rabbi Soloveitchik asked this very question in a Yahrzeit Shir, 1956-57. I was well prepared, came to mind, this is terrific. Everyone, that's a good question. The audience now is interested. And I wanted to explain, and this is the heart of understanding who we are, why we're different, why the New York Times will never understand this, why liberal Jews have no concept of what Torah is about. I want to explain. Yes, we need both covenants, because Judaism functions on a dual level. On the first level, we're like any other religion in the world. Religion is a personal matter, individualistic matter, between the individual and the Almighty. That's the covenant with Abraham Avinu. If Moshe Rabbeinu, we come up to a second level. Being a Jew is not just being an individual Jew. We are concomitantly, simultaneously, an integral part of a people, a nation, a brotherhood. We are all interconnected. This is the concept of Am Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, Adat Yisrael, Kahal Yisrael. The Torah is not given to an individual. It's given to the collected peoplehood of the Jewish people. Eretz Yisrael is not given to an individual. It's given to the collected unity of B'nai Yisrael. And this is why, before we leave Egypt and this great process is about to unfold, about to begin, look how we have to prepare ourselves. Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. What is unique about it? The Passover sacrifice, when do you eat it? We eat today, in memory of the Korban Pesach, we eat the Afikomen. If anyone has an appetite to eat the Afikomen on Seder night, stand up and let us count you. We're lucky we're still awake, Afikomen. Matzah, and today with the Shayurim, I don't have to tell you. Mara, the sandwich. And then the women that work so hard. The hard-boiled egg, soup, the main course, dessert, two cups of wine behind us. Have to remind ourselves, oy vey, we need the Afikomen. That's when you wake the Korban Pesach. Al Hasova, you were totally satiated. Hundreds of Jews, Josephus describes it, thousands of Jews, hundreds of families, we joined together with one lamb. But that's symbolic. Joining together. Unity. Becoming one. Becoming a people. We need both covenants. And Judaism functions on both levels. There's a dialectical tension here. On one hand, Torah is a religion. It resembles other religions. No one will tell a Gentile, you have to be a Jew. We respect them, observe the basic commandments, the Noahic commandments. You have your religion. We have our religion. But we have a second level, brotherhood, people. A collective destiny, a cohesiveness, a concern, a unity. Other people do not have this. And I'll illustrate it in a few minutes. But I said to the soldiers, my dear colleagues, I said, until now, we really didn't comprehend what Pesach was about. This is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Pesach is 2 weeks away. Until now we were Americans, Canadians, Australians, Brazilians, Russians, Moroccans. We were individuals. the Israeli army has forged us into a true peoplehood, a real unit, a collective cohesiveness. This Pesach will be very different. This Pesach, we truly will be worthy of partaking of the Passover sacrifice. We have come home, and we have the totality of Jewish experience for the first time in our lives. Baruch Hashem, that particular lecture in the army became a career afterwards. Unknown to me, the commander of the base, and Lieutenant Colonel Iskander Luf, follows me, gets a report every day of what happened. The next day, I'm invited to meet with the commander of the base. And he tells me, a Romanian survivor of the Holocaust, and he starts telling me that this never happened before, trainee speaking. And I didn't realize he wants to get a good grade with the upper people. So he sends on a report to the chief rabbi of the IDF at that time, Major General Gat-Navon. A few days later, I'm invited to meet with General Navon, and the rest is history. I went into the lecture club, the rabbinate, and it was for the next 15 years, many blessed experiences. And as Larry said, when I was kicked out the first time, when I turned 49, I filed a protest, and they accepted me back. At 54, the computer said, absolutely goodbye. Now, the New York Times will never understand this, and you see the liberal Jews, you hear the way they speak, you see what their ideas are. Who would ever dream reforming conservative rabbis come to Israel to work with Palestinians and encourage them and maledict our children, our grandchildren, your children, your grandchildren, and all that is constructive and happening on the land that God gave us. They will never understand it. And it's frightening, of course, that that voice has so influenced the man who is president of the United States. So you have to ask a different question, and I want to illustrate this very poignantly. I am a third-generation American. My wife's family goes back to the 1870s in the United States. Why did we have the guts to leave America, to go on Aliyah? And I can tell you, you go to school for many years. People will ask me how many years, you know, they have these forms, how many years were you in school? I said, I've never left. They probably think I'm very dumb. The story of a guy in Lakewood is a true story. In the Beit Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood Yeshiva, where I learned in the early 50s. So Friday afternoon, we always had off. They could do whatever you want. So this is after I was in Lakewood, no one had a car in my time. But they tell a story, someone was driving, he went through a stop sign, and the policeman pulls him over. And as he's writing the ticket, he says to him, how many years have you been here in the yeshiva? And this poor kid answers, 13 years. And the policeman says, well, you must be awfully dumb if you've been in the yeshiva for 13 years. Now, the truth of the matter is, we go to school so many years, and, you know, I just heard about a kid today in school, bright, but not motivated. And you know, you get kids, you go to school, they're bored, they're, I don't know, what do we have? And you know, teachers, with all due respect, not every teacher is the greatest teacher, and not every great teacher can be great at every moment, and the kid, all right, a kid is bored. I always told it to my own children, not that anyone listens to it, everyone else that knows more than a mechanech of 52 years will, in 2 weeks, start his 53rd year, but that doesn't matter. I'm so opposed to skipping kids. I tell them, I've always told my kids, my grandchildren, you don't go to school to learn. You go to school to develop social grits. To learn how to speak to your friends, someone your age, how to interact. A bright kid, you pick up the basics, and all your life, you're going to build on what you picked up in school. Learning is on your own. But school is to become a mensch. But nevertheless, there's a moment or two in your life in school, you go to school so many years, that that class changed my life. Tell the story here of the class that changed my life. 1944, I came into the elementary yeshiva I was going to. Was known anyone here from the Bronx? Yeshiva Rabbi Israel Salanta, the only yeshiva or day school in the Bronx, was called Yeshiva Parochial School. Come into Salanta, 44, and all the kids are talking. We're all talking what America's going to do. Normandy, yet in Normandy, where are they going to land? Everybody who America was, the Allies were going to land. And we had maps with us. And the teacher, Mr. Markowitz, says to us, says to us in Hebrew, you probably think I'm an old man, you're young kids, you know how to fight. He says, I fought in World War I. And I'll tell you a story. So he tells us he was a kid of 17. He and his friend were on the front line for the Russians. World War I was the last war that was fought soldier against soldier. They're shooting at the Germans. His friend scores a direct hit. The German drops his rifle and with his last breath shouts, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. My friend committed suicide, he told us, in a Russian field hospital 2 days later. I don't want to tell you in parentheses, if you read Chaim Sabato's latest book, Bohi HaRuach, the whole book evolves around a similar story from World War I. You can't believe it. I sent them a copy of my manuscript where I describe it, and you can imagine how many times it happened if I wrote a book about it, and Chaim Sabato wrote, and who knows who else has written or heard about it or experienced a similar tragedy. What does it mean, Am Yisrael? What am I so upset about? What am I talking about? Tell me, how many of you come from Germany, France, Alsace-Lorraine? How many times did the Germans fight the French over Alsace-Lorraine? Christian versus Christian, Christian killing Christian. Who cared? Modern times, 1990s, Volkwang, Argentina versus Britain, blood was shed, Christian versus Christian. 1982, my unit going up to Beirut, and I have a very fascinating picture in here of myself and my commander standing at the entrance to Beirut where there are two signs up, Baruch Boacha Beirut. Welcome to Beirut. And next to it, Lecha Dumia Tehillah. It was a play on words that silence, military silence, is golden. Lecha, it's a play on words. Dumia, silence, that is praiseworthy. Tehillah. You'll see the sign. Israeli army has a sense of humor. So we're going up to Beirut, and in Damur, look at the map, it's right beneath Beirut. The Israeli army uncovers something like 18, 20 Jews who never got out, who were caught there, trapped there. Tell me, if this would be the American army, are they Lebanese? They'd execute them, capture them. For us, they were Jews. Israel quickly did a security check. They were moved behind our lines, back to Rosh HaNikra, back into Israel. 48 hours later, they were residents of Kfar Chabad with Israeli citizenship papers. A true story. You can take the papers out from the war. It was written up in every newspaper. So that's exactly what the Second Covenant is about. That's exactly our uniqueness. that's exactly which binds us together. And let me say something else. And everything I'm saying, everything I'm referring to with a lot more is elaborated upon in this volume. Whenever I mention the name of Senpo Sugihara, I always say, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And here you have to appreciate what I'm saying. If you didn't live the era, you have no concept. I went to Yeshiva Salanta. Who were my teachers? Who taught in America? America is a land in which you have to make money. What was America called in Yiddish? The golden medina. Right? Oh, God, you have gold today. It really is the golden medina. That's a different problem. America has dollar bills. It doesn't have the gold. The golden medina. You went to work. Read my biography in the place of Sue. He came to America, he sold insurance. He went bankrupt, so they told him, Laser, Ba'ash Pasnov, Gaylarainen Arabanur. Arabanur, but in Yiddish, Rabbanus. For you, I only translated. But they told him, Laser, when he went bankrupt, for you, with your abilities, forget about making money as a businessman. Go into the rabbin. So the teachers we got were, to use a modern Hebrew word, the low use lachni. These were misfits. They didn't succeed. They knew a little Gemara from their youth. They weren't from. They weren't totally Shama Shabbos. That year, they hebratized names. I remember Shiloni and other names like that. And you had big Yichus names. Twesky, I remember Shabbos when they gave Bar Mitzvah lessons. Kids put money into the Chumash. That this is the way they were paid on Shabbos. Yeah, who taught? When taught? How much of an influence could they have? Not today. It's a different era. And Senpo Sugihara, that individual, and you know how much has been written, how much research, Professor Levin and Brandeis did postdoctoral research. Why did he save all these Jews? Why did he do it? They try to find the motive. Generally speaking, people do good, but they do good. There's a reason behind it. He couldn't find any motive. He interviewed his first wife, his second wife, his friends. It was unbelievable. And finally, when they located him, the man disappeared. Senpo Sugihara disappeared. The ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to Russia, located him in Moscow years later. And they asked him, he said, what do you mean? Why did I do good? How could I not do good? These were innocent people. You have to do good because God put you on the world to do good and do what is proper. And he saved the entire Mir Yeshiva. It's beyond comprehension. I can't go into all the details, but it's Hashgacha Pratit, step after step after step. And they arrived, half of them went to America, half of them went to Israel. In Israel today, the Mir Yeshiva, you don't have enough computer strength to count all the students that study there. My Talmud, Rabbi Ayams, I went to visit him in Mir. He took me on a tour. Wherever you went, building after building after building, hundreds, thousands, learning. If you come in after 9:30, if you're late, you lost your seat. Am I right? 9:30, cut off. You lost your seat. The Talmidim who came to America, what are they going to do for Parnassa? And every yeshiva from Maimonides in Boston to Baltimore, to RJJ, Chaim Berlin, Teir Vadas, and Yeshiva Salanta. And here we saw these, what was to us, strange-looking people. They never went to a baseball game. They couldn't speak English. But we knew they were Jews. And we knew they had seen the earlier generation, and our hearts met. We didn't need language at first. We saw greatness. tell you a little story. It's not a little story. It's a deep story. And if you really want the whole story, it's 2 years' worth of lectures on the Muslim movement. I had a Rebbe in eighth grade, Reb Henoch Fishman. Little did I dream that a few years later, Reb Henoch, Reb Yeshen Yakovlevich, and you're truly a little American bum, that the three of us would be on the Reitz faculty teaching Talmud in the Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchok Chanan. Then I was a kid, eighth grade. Reb Henoch, something so different about him. And Friday night we'd go over to his house, we believe it was, you know, the Bronx, and again the Bronx, it's not like Toronto, not like Baltimore, not like Borough Park, the Bronx I was raised in, who was Shayim Shabbos, we defined in Shul on Shabbos, 6:30 in the morning there was a big minyan, 8 o'clock they all beat it out of there, made kiddush, had breakfast, put on their work clothes and went to work. The regular minyan was kids until the age of 15, 16, and retirees over 70. That's the way we grew up. So we had like an oasis. We went to our Rebbe's house, have a little Lomek Shabbat, and his wife always served chocolate cake. She didn't be well. She lives in Arzei Habirate in Yerushalayim. Rebbe's in Werner. It's her second husband, also an Altamira. And we noticed that Rebbe never finishes the last piece of cake. Nope, you see it 1 week, it's an accident. 2 weeks, interesting. 3 weeks already, an American kid is inquisitive, Rebbe Shuldik. Why do you leave it over? Why? You like the cake. Your wife is a good baker. And the answer he gave me, believe me, I didn't understand it at the time. But I published so many pages and gave so many lectures as a result. He said, it's been a Talmud from Yeruchim Levatz, the famous Mira Mashgiach. It was a Talmud from Yeruchim. He taught me Musa. What is Musa about? To be able to control your desires. Man should be the master of himself. The New York Times, there's no past, there's no future, do whatever you want. The governor of New York, the mayor, I told Jews in Barbara, how can you live there? It's like what they permitted, I don't want to mention the name in a shoe, those type of marriages, which, not just they permitted, morons, with glee, with joy, with happiness, a glick of umsgetroffen, the greatest day since Bria Ta'olam, according to the New York Times, that Sunday all these couples could get married. It's the end of the human race. We didn't live through the Dor HaMabul, and this doesn't mean, by the way, we hate, we kill. God forbid we accept, we understand their problems. We're psychologists and sexologists, but I don't get it. And I know what problems, how many times we've been able to solve them. But this is the New York Times. How could they ever understand the Reb Henoch Fishman? Leaving over a beautiful last little piece of the chocolate cake to show that he is the master of his ta'avot, of his desires. What an impact that had on an American bookstore. And you see, these are worlds not in collision. These are Jews. Reb Henoch, Polish, Lithuanian, Chinese, Shanghai, New York. And what influence on a little Jewish kid and many others who could barely speak his language at the time. And let me go one step further. Let me make one more major point and then we'll come down to the book. You see, our greatest struggle as Jews and in transmitting our heritage, our understanding, our commitment to the next generation is we all live in the great big world today. You can't hide from it. We all are exposed to doom culture. And it's a tremendous challenge to keep our Torah values above Western, contemporary, modern, sophisticated influence. The pressures on us are great. Sometimes we don't even realize how deep and demanding, how intruding the outside world is. My Rebbe, Mori Rebbe Ras Soloveitchik, would always speak about Avraham Avinu turning to the Hittites, and he says to them, Ger v'tosha anochi imachem. Now what does it mean? If you're a stranger, you're not a resident. And if you're a resident, you're not a stranger. And Ras Soloveitchik would explain so beautifully, we have to balance out two different worlds. On one hand, we are different than everyone else. I've just spoken about it for 40 minutes. We're not like the New York Times. We're not like Obama. We're not like the so-called liberal Jews, Tikkun Olam, all of Judaism. Tikkun Olam is beautiful, but first there has to be Tikkun of yourself, Tikkun of the Jewish people, Tikkun of the Jewish nation, and of course will be a light unto the Gentiles. Or like on you, absolutely. They can't understand it. We're different. Our day of rest is different. Have you ever seen the way Gentiles celebrate Sunday? I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood, one-third Jewish, one-third Italian, one-third Irish. They have it made. They go to Mass 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock Sunday morning. The whole Mass is 1 hour. You don't need a Kiddush club. You don't need, you don't have to chat during it. 1 hour all over. They come home. It's amazing. Sit down with the TV, the football game of the week, beer, pretzels. When I was a kid, it was the kosher pretzel. I thought the whole world stood on the pace of those pretzels that they ate while they watched the game of the week on Sunday. Today in the New York area, I can tell you there isn't a pretzel that's not kosher. We've come full cycle. And in Israel, they imitate Bachman. They think pretzels have to have a bee. If it's not a bee, there's not a key to the pretzel. It's a key in the chepzer of a pretzel. Bachman's. What a world. How can they understand our Shabbos? How can they understand our kashrut? How can the New York Times ever understand Tarat HaMishpacha? It's beyond them. It's not even in their frame of reference. Self-control, dignity, sanctity. When did you last see those words in the Western world? So we're again. On the other hand, we're part of the great human race. My heart goes out to those who are not Toshavim. I saw it in my travels across the world. I see it in Israel. You have children who don't graduate elementary school. Just learn. Have no profession. Have no dignity. Later in life, they face very serious problems, and there's a unfortunately, the percentage that throws it all away, angry at their parents. I can tell you stories that I've seen in my life. Frightening. Wounded. Self-imposed by rebellion who tell them, I quote you what one late boy told me, not one of his children remained from some rebbe in high school told him that work is a curse and you don't get involved with a curse unless you have to. So of course, he never got a profession. And by the time he wanted a profession and needed a profession, it was too late. And I pity such people. It is anti-Torah, anti-Gemara, anti-everything that Shas and Poskim teach us. It's an open Gemara, the second tradition. Unbelievable. So we are Toshavim. We are part of the big world. We get sick. We need doctors. We need research. Two ladies who wear tichels in research in Hadassah Medical School in Yerushalayim of the Hebrew University, just to come up with a tremendous discovery that may aid in the process of Be'ezrat Hashem of conquering cancer. On that level, the whole world will benefit. Israel, 23% of the patents on medical devices are owned by Israelis living in the state of Israel. 23% of them. Mechshirei Refuah is the modern Hebrew term for it. So of course we're part of the big world. We live in both worlds. And it's so important to balance it out. It's so important to have proper values. And here, let me add one more word of thanks. I described my book, my education, my teachers. I described Lakewood. I photographed in words for Baron Cutler, the Alta Kletska, what Lakewood was like, Lithuania in the early 50s, not Lakewood of today. Lakewood of today is an American institution. But Lakewood in the early 50s was still, when you walked in, they put a mask on your face and you would grieve only Lithuanian air. It was a pleasure, like an airplane where they tell you as the oxygen mask will fall down, you walk into Lakewood, plop on your nose, and wow. I describe Reb Aaron, the Alta Mashkiach. I describe Yeshiva University in my time. I compare Moriah Rebbe of Soloveitchik to Reb Aaron Cutler. There's ample description of Chabad in this book. But with it all, and all that I received, I got a very important message from an organization that has contributed beyond any other youth organization you can mention to the greatest miracle of all since Churban HaBayit, the building of the State of Israel, the fact that this year there will be 6 million Jews who can be halakhically defined as Jews. Not like they say in America, there are 5 million Jews. You investigate that, of that 5 million, you'll be lucky. If you're left with 3.5 million, I will be amazed. What a miracle. B'nai Akiva, their contributions are endless. And I got something out of B'nai Akiva I got nowhere else. They taught me not to accept that American value, that money, is so important. The American dream, and that's a tosha, there's nothing wrong with it. Dignity. Money, I once asked a friend of mine who was a multi-millionaire, I said, what do you do with all your money? Well, he says, you know, I give some charity. But all that money, he says, yeah, but you got to understand, the more zeros I write, the more influence I have. All right, he gave me a good answer. But to go on Aliyah, to build this state, what we have accomplished, but you had to have that ability to look beyond the American dream, to look beyond the Western dream. And this complemented the messages I received learning Torah at the feet of Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. And I give B'nai Akiva a great thank you that it made me more of a ger and less of a toshav. So to reiterate, we talk about religious Zionism. Religious Zionism means a romance with the Almighty, with His Torah, with His people, with His land. If we can convey that feeling of romance, of love to our children, we have a even brighter future than what we have today. The key to chinuch is romance. That's exactly the word that describes the saga of our people from Matan Torah until this very moment at Beit Mashiach Tzidkenu. Am Yisrael is our unique concept. We must understand it, live by it, and communicate it further. As you know, I was privileged to write 6 books of pure scholarship. What am I talking about? You're right on the time. Larry commented when he first met your brother to take a drink of water, how many minutes it is until the lecture. This should be up. Rabbi Rebel, Rabbi Silva, 2 volumes of Rakaf and Aaron, 2 volumes of the Rav. When I was doing my research on the Rav, I came across, I knew a young man had come out of the Rav from Portland, Oregon, the early 70s. A Yeshiva College graduate, his father, a prominent conservative rabbi in Portland, a fabulous young man, Shaul Stamfer, Professor Stamfer. We became friendly, and he did a brilliant doctorate on Yeshiva Tulash at the Hebrew University. I studied the first edition that when the communism fell, he had to revise a lot, and they had to put out an entire new second edition. I left it. And I noticed that 90% of his work is based upon memoir literature. And I said, no one has written memoir literature on what you have been part and have seen in your life. And I will add something that I'm not speaking about now, but I'm married to a very brave woman. She always goaded me, you want to have the guts to go to Russia. All my Talmidim were going, communist Russia we're talking about. And one day I got a call in May of 1980. You're willing to accept the call, but you cannot reveal its contents. And I've gotten calls like this from students that cannot, if I had any sacral, I would write books, stories my students have told me. I'd be able to buy half of this community, believe me. Here, everyone's dancing for joy. The publisher can't believe it. My book came out July 15th. They ran 1,000 copies for Israel. It sold out within 48 hours. A lady wanted to buy a copy here to ship to Israel. Just a few minutes ago, a lady spoke. I called her, don't you dare. They just did a second printing. It'll be in the stores, if not this week, next week in Israel. But all right, Baruch Hashem, 1,000 copies sold out in 48 hours. Write us a book like this, 100,000 copies in 48 hours. Stories my students have told me. So I always tell them, I'm not a priest. We don't have a concept that the priest can give you some. I don't want to mention, I know Catholic theology, I grew up in the neighborhood, but what you're doing is terrible. You have to do tshuva. So I figure it's one of those calls. So a minute later, a gentleman gets on the phone whose name I was never allowed to reveal until they lifted the security clause. And my book is actually his picture, a man whom I revere, Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha, and Aryeh Kroll, Shemus Harabe Kefet. Anachnu yodim shel paideicho lameid gemara, him atam uchan lameid gemara b'Moskva. Will you teach Gemara in Moscow? And I said yes, and began a long process of 10 years that my wife and I worked with the Mossad, and there are a number of chapters. My last conversation with Aryeh was giving me permission to tell the entire story of our unit. It is fascinating, and there are a number of chapters here. But when I looked at Shaul Stamfer's book, I said, this is what I have to do, Be'ezrat Hashem. And 11 years I worked on it. And I was very privileged that the OU, I had a miracle here that 2 years ago the OU went into publishing, and they brought in a top quality young man, Rabbi Gil's student, He took my book and he helped me and he edited it. What a job he did. He worked there exactly 2 years. From the day I came to the day the book went to press. Told him in a shmai. He said, you know, he's an actuary. So he has little two guys to make a living that way. You know, I've always spoken. He's not a B'nai Akiva, and it's not Israel. So he had to leave, and I tell him, Gil, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam sent you just to bring this book to fruition. The OU, I asked them to partner. They always have to partner with someone. It's not like Oxford that has its own printing facilities in China. No, I'm serious. It's done in China. The OU doesn't have those type of facilities, so they partnered with Geffen. And I have to say that I don't believe, you know, this is as good a job as you would get anywhere. Kol hakavod to Geffen. What I want to comment on and end off is on some of the pictures. I consider the 32 pages of pictures, I consider the only pictures of me were pictures that my students insisted I put in, because I get lost in the book. It's a scholarly memoir, it's not an autobiography. But there are pictures that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam privileged me to take and to publish. And I want to mention a few so that you will appreciate what you're seeing. By far, one picture already, people are running after me on both sides of the oceans for permission to reprint. Chabad had a picture of a dinner in 1942. Sitting at the table was a young rabbi with a black beard. Nobody in Chabad knew who that rabbi was. Anyone who has a phone, I want you to put it on the hatikva, so when it rings, it rings the hatikva. Okay, we have to accept the phones, emergencies, calls, but let it ring hatikva. There is someone sitting in this audience who heard me say it in class, and he changed his phone to ring hatikva. Thus, haste a Talmud. So no one in Chabad could tell who this man was. My book on the Rav came out in 99, my two volumes. In the first volume I have a portrait gallery of the Rav. And there's a picture from 1939. Few years later, they made the connection that this is Rabbi Soloveitchik. They gave me the picture with the permission to be the first one to publish it officially. It is Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik sitting together with the sixth Rebbe and his sons-in-law, including looking directly at you, a young man with a little black band, his son-in-law, who would later become the seventh Rebbe, Rebbe Nachum Mendel Schneerson. It is not a photo montage. It is not a photo that was touched by a computer. It is a real picture. I consider that, there are no words for that. If you understand what that means, Mori Rebbe, the great, 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 great grandson of Rav Chaim Volozhin, the Talmid Lufak of the Vilna Gaon, and the Lubavitcher Rebbeim, direct descendants of the Alter Rebbe. And when the Alter Rebbe came to Vilna, the Vilna Gaon left the city rather than look at him, see him, or breathe the same air. Depends what tradition you heard. And here you have the picture, the Rav with the two Rebbeim. It's quite a picture. Let me say a word in memory of Meir Kahan. The history of what we did for the Jews in Russia is now people are starting to write doctorates on it. A lot of research is being done in the state of Israel. There'll be a volume out in Hebrew in about a year's time that will be about the Mossad in general in Russia, not just the one branch that I talk about. And a lot more work is being done. So I noticed one of the works that came out in America, Professor Feingold, they put Meir Kahan down as a footnote. He had no influence, he was an extremist, a hothead, etc. I only can tell you I publish a full page picture. I have to once again thank the OU and get them and cooperating with me and not turning my pictures into postage stamps, full-page picture of refusing to come to see me in Leningrad with his most precious possession sticking out of his pocket, a picture of Mayor Kahane. So I think you can see from that picture that Mayor did quite a bit of good in raising the morale of the refusing community behind the Iron Curtain. And you young people here, you live in the computer world. When you buy, my grandsons buy a computer game, 6 months later they ask me for more money, I have to contribute again, I have to be a Shikafa partner, a new version came out. You buy a phone, a schmoe, I don't know, my grandchildren have gone through so many phones, I don't have enough fingers. And each phone, they dance for you, they give you shots and pice for you, they dopping for you. You see these, no, see, they turn on the phones, they, everyone's, no one's dominating, the phones are dominating for them. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. So, you young people, I cry, you don't know what the Communist Empire was. You're a snigger, you think of Russia today. Russia today, you get in easier than you get into Canada. Take my word for it. It's at religion. Chabad owns Russia today. Putin wears a gato. Okay? You guys don't know what we're talking about. And you got to give Mayor credit. And then I have two more pictures I want to tell you about. These are pictures that I took. I took the one of Mayor as well. But these are pictures, wow. This was one that the Israeli TV wanted to use, but the Mossad was afraid it would leak out. Israelis are in Russia. They vetoed it. Saturday night, 1981, Malka and I are coming to this house right after Shabbos, and they're going to wait for us to come. They'll make Havdalah when we get there. These are people raised on atheism, godlessness, the communist state, the corporate state. There's no individuality. It's all the state. And we come in, and Zalman Kumik is standing next to Danny Fradkin. Danny Fratkin's going to make Havdalah. Daniel Fradkin is the only family in Leningrad that never, ever was Mechallel Shabbos. Not World War II, not the communists, he and his wife, both from old-time Chabad families. And then he's making Havdalah, then they get to the Nair, and Zalman lights two matches. But then I notice on the table, you see this in the picture, on the table is a Havdalah candle from Eretz Yisrael. So I asked them, where did you get that candle? A tourist smuggled it in. Why don't you use it? Because we can't replace it. So why do you leave it on the table? You have matches. No, we leave it on the table so that when we make Havdalah, we connect ourselves to Eretz Yisrael. Now you just think about that answer. Halavai in Toronto and Baltimore and Borough Park. When you make Havdalah, use matches and leave a candle for Eretz Yisrael on the table with a loud and clear message. Ashrei Ayin Ra'ata Zot. And finally, the picture that says it all and ties us right back to an hour plus when I began this shayur. In a house in Leningrad, a kid came from Odessa, Nacho Hushka the Torah, wanted to learn what it's about. In Odessa, there was nobody. Leningrad had an underground, a little bit of a Chabad movement. Yitzchak Kogin, he's a Kogin, you'll see his picture in my book with David Applebaum, Dr. Applebaum, Hashem, you come to him next to him. And had an underground of Torah. The kid knew, and he became a Chabadnik, well known today in Israel. And he drew a picture. Am Yisrael Chai. And the picture, the aphorism, was hanging on the inside of a door in Leningrad. Am Yisrael Chai. And I snapped the picture. And when you look at it, he made a mistake. He'll see the arm with a normal member. No, Betty, he made a mistake. I say, no, he didn't make a mistake. Min ha-shamayim zikunu, God privileged us to have this picture because it tells us, Am Yisrael will never end. The Jewish people, what a romance, what a story. And here we are, and we can shout in dignity with all the heartache of today and all the terrible news. And yet, we have to go further, and we have to declare, Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you very, very much.